Welcome to Vassals of Kingsgrave, the friendliest place on the internet. My name is Glenn Blackshepherd from the podcast Face and Fire forums, and I am joined by Bina.
Hi everybody, it's Bina 007 on the forums.
And at a proud moment, we do have a new host today, so introduce yourself.
Katie, I'm Tandana on the forums.
And how is it that you discovered VOK?
I'm one of those YouTube people that found you through YouTube because of the Feast Dance rereads.
Oh,
that
good.
Put up, and I couldn't stop listening to them because there was someone who thought Victorian was the prince that was promised, and I just couldn't stop listening because he kept bringing it off at like really weird times, and it was just fascinating. And I have listened to the other ones as well, like the linear reread and all that, but the Silmarillion and some of the TV series ones as well. Don't use YouTube anymore because it's easier on my phone.
Oh, and is it through when you were listening to YouTube that someone said about joining the podcast Face and Fire forums?
Yes, yeah, that's right. Okay. I found like through the WordPress, and then through the forums, because I actually haven't listened to much podcast of Ice and Fire, just because it has such a large backlog.
Oh yeah,
I'm trying to go through the BBC In Our Time backlog from like 1998 to now.
Brilliant taste. I love In Our Time. It's one of my all-time favorite podcasts.
Oh, it's so good. I love Melvin Bragg. He heard Cats like academic wrangling. I don't know how he does it.
And it's amazing because it's 40 minutes, but you really do feel you've got this nuanced insight into whatever topic they're covering.
Yeah, and I love some of the people that just pop up, like in the late 90s ones, like Richard Dawkins is on about three. And then one of my favorite historians, Helen Castor, is on quite a few, talking about women in early medieval lives. And
it really is the creme de la creme.
Yeah, I found so many books and the reading list. So good.
Absolutely.
Between that and Thinking Aloud, I'm just, yeah. It's weird because my first podcast is with like OG Bach people, so I'm not nervous at all. Like, I have my shit together.
You shouldn't be nervous at all.
Am I allowed to curse?
Of course you are allowed to curse. Sure. And actually, I think it's much easier doing your first podcast when it's just three of us than if it were a big reread one where there's 8 or 9 people.
Oh, I know.
It's one of the reasons that I haven't signed up for the linear reread, just because I would have to go back and read a couple of... Well, it's not so much the reading, but it's the amount of people. And depending on the chapters coming up are really big chapters. Like, they're slowly amping up to the Red Wedding, so maybe after that calms down.
Yeah.
Tina's the right person to talk to if you want to join one of those.
Actually, I passed on scheduling duties to Casey, Blue-Eyed Queen, who's doing an amazing job, but I am hosting Reread 40. And you're right, in that one she's parceled up just 3 chapters to discuss, because I think the chapters start getting quite dense and, you know, you want to give them the proper time.
Yeah, the last one that they posted was just 4 chapters and it was big.
I know.
Like, they got it down to 2 hours after, like, 4.
Yeah, for the editing.
That was me.
But if there's ever a Tales and Duncan Egg,
well,
like,
done, Glenn. That was amazing.
Books, come on.
Sorry, Katie.
Yeah. Sorry, the Full Castle read of A Hedge Knight was amazing.
The people who edit and do the sound effects on the FCRs, I've got so much respect for, because it's a whole nother layer of editing than just getting the audio right. It's actually it's like creative, isn't it, in a way? So I really respect that.
Yeah, I have mates who work in more TV and film sound stuff and filming stuff, and it's doing a Full Castle reread is like doing a radio play. It's essentially the same thing. It's so much goes into it.
Absolutely.
They are the best podcasts that we have available, I would say, like of all the podcasts that we've done. So
don't they go for like 7 hours? You kind of need to book out an entire day to dedicate to it, because there's not only the reading, but there's the discussion after.
Although I have to say, I remember once doing a reread cast where it was just like a fun crew. I guess everyone didn't have places to be. It's the one that's called
Is it one of the ones with Wargasm?
I think it's,
It's just like, every time he's on one, I can sit and listen to it for hours. I want like the non-edited version.
Come back, Wargasm. He just disappeared. We don't know where he's gone, poor thing. But it was the Canada cast, which I do think he was on, and the record time was 5 hours, of which most of it was just after show giggling. But it was so much fun.
But yes, today we will be talking about Harlots. So I guess, a little watched show that's available on Hulu and also ITV Encore in the UK, set in the 1700s, about two rival brothels. And I guess for people that haven't, but that are maybe listening just now and are not sure, is there anything you would say to convince them to watch Harlots?
Sack back dresses. All the sack back dresses.
Costumes. I mean, for me, it's all about the social history, and you're seeing, I think, a really fascinating period of history through the eyes of these very strong, economically entrepreneurial women who are running brothels, because that's one way you can do business as a woman in that period. And I think it's just really interesting because you get to see corruption in high places and a lot of the morality around what they do. And I think it's kind of nice because it does tackle issues like slavery and race relations and all sorts of stuff goes on. So it is fun and it's quite light, but there's a lot of really dark and deep stuff in there as well. So it's a nice mix.
Anachronistic for having like women owning brothels at that point. Like, that's actually true to life. Prostitutes had quite a bit of economic freedom once they got to like the bawdy house level.
Yeah, that's the lovely thing.
Men tended to not be involved.
Yeah, it's based on a series of historical research novels by Hallie Rubenhold, so there is proper history behind it. Sorry, Glenn, anyway, what would be your selling point for this series? Because you're the one who raised the call to arms, so what do you love about it?
I think that one thing that drew me to it is the time period, because I don't think there's a lot of shows that are set during the Georgian period. So I liked that. I liked the setting of the show. It's a great costume, big ensemble drama as well. And I've really, really enjoyed the stories as well, some of the storylines that you have. So it's really just a great, I guess, bit of escapism as well, in the sense that you think, oh God, thank God my life's not that horrible. Because as the show starts, it says 1 in 5 women are selling themselves in their line of work. And then it goes through each of the characters and the stories. So they bring up a lot of great, so slavery, of course, that they bring up murder, virginity, a lot of great storylines as well. And I think in terms of the ITV Encore, so it's a new channel available in the UK. I think it is the highest, like the most popular show that they have done as well.
Yeah, and they had a huge marketing campaign before it, well, it felt like it was a decent marketing campaign before it came out. Like, I was really conscious it was coming out. And I think they have very much marketed it as, you know, you might think of these women typically in fiction as being oppressed and forced into it. And certainly one of the characters, the rival, does lock the women in. But they wanted to show how actually for some women it was economically empowering. And that's what was shocking about the first episode.
So it's like,
the daughter was so matter of fact, yeah, I'm going to go and sell my virginity now because that's what you do. So it's a new take. It's a fresh take on quite a hackneyed stories. I mean, there are no hookers with a heart of gold in this series, I don't think.
Fanny.
Yeah, gorgeous Fanny, maybe Fanny. She's sweet.
Love it a bit.
But it's not the usual, is it? It's not the usual sort of, oh, I guess, you know, like, I'm dying of consumption, I'm beautiful, a young handsome lord will fall in love with me, but it will be tragic. That's the kind of the opera version of the prostitute story, and this definitely is not that.
And Bina and I were talking about it. There's a theme going throughout the show about betrayal as well, which I love. That's like several of the storylines link up. So Harriet betrays Margaret, but that's for her children. Then Margaret kills Howard, and that's for her daughter. So like all of these things that happen, that then Margaret betrays Lacey, what's her name?
Emily Lacey
to Lydia, and that's to protect her daughter. So a lot of betrayal happens, and that's to protect their loved ones.
It just reminded me, because obviously we in On Vogue do a lot of Song of Ice and Fire stuff, and where we're getting to in the reread, there's obviously lots of very controversial decisions taken by Kat to supposedly protect her children or to try and rescue her daughters. And I just thought there's something in this show as well about what desperation will drive you to do, and some really dark and morally ambiguous stuff goes on. So to protect your daughter, you're going to give up Emily Lacey. Wow. I just thought it was really, really nice. And one of the questions I wanted to ask you guys later, after all Glenn's points, is who do you think is the heroine of this story? Because at first I thought it was Samantha Morton as this powerful, entrepreneurial, strong, no-nonsense brothel keeper. But they take her to such a dark place. I was thinking, wow, you know, that's really brave and ballsy. But maybe that's a discussion point for later on.
Harriet, I think she's the heroine.
Wow, really? She's a minor character, though.
Yeah, she is a minor character, but everything she does is for her children to keep them out of servitude or out of slavery, right? But Margaret Wells is unable to see that she has the money and the ability to educate her daughters to not go into her line of work. And she can't see outside of her position in life, so she forces her daughters into it. But, you know, because you see, she played the stuttering nurse on Call the Midwife.
Don't watch
crazy,
that.
The preaching woman with the blind one with her daughter.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
You know, she decided to change her life around when she had a daughter.
Yeah, but what is her daughter's economic outlook? I mean, I think I would have sympathy for you if Samantha Morton, as a brothel madam, had a young son and had said, you know, I'm going to spend my money on educating you, and then you can go off and have maybe a lower working class profession, like become, I don't know, a clerk in a bank office or something, then fine, and you can escape. But with a young daughter in that period, if you educate her, what's she going to be, like a governess or something? There's not really school teachers yet as such. I mean, what really were the professions open to working class women at that time if the mum's got money?
They weren't, and I agree with you now, because the whole 1 in 5 statistic, it seems really high, but it takes into account women who weren't prostitutes full time. It's women who would occasionally, you know, bounce up their paycheck with taking that kind of work occasionally when it came up for them. So it's not like 1 in 5 women in London at that time were on the street selling themselves. That number is quite a bit lower, but the amount of women who would supplement their income with sex work was very high.
Yeah.
And Margaret does say that she always hopes it's going to be a boy because she knows that it will lead to prostitution if it is a girl.
So I think the more interesting...
quickly, like, she had a boy and she puts him in the same situation where...
So that, I think, is far more culpable because a boy would have had other options. A boy with some education, the ability to read and write well and do some math, could have been sent apprenticed as a clerk in an accountant's office, a bookkeeper's, a law office. So I think Mark Quigley is far more culpable than Ma Wells in that respect.
And you were talking about, Tabina, that it's based, so the show is based on a book called The Harlots. No, it's, what is it? The Covent Garden Ladies, I think. But then that's also based on sort of like a guide that was published in the 1700s. So all the popular prostitutes in London, and that was known as the Harris Lists.
Yeah, so basically there was in the period a genuine guide put together by a couple of rascally, maybe quasi-aristo rich young men, which was a guide to all the brothel houses in London. So you could, in this small guide that they printed, and that was very popular, called Harris's List, you could say, right, if you want to find a particularly buxom whore or one who specialises in S&M, it can give you the descriptions. And the descriptions are really, some of them are quite funny, some of them are quite sweet. They describe the looks of the women, their personalities, their skill set. And this was very, you know, it was like proper advertising. It could make or break someone and certainly advertise them. And a lot of kind of historical novels on the time make reference to it. And then basically there's a British historian / fiction writer called Hallie Reubenhold. And she's written a couple of books, actually. Like, she's written one called The Scandalous Lady W. And that was, or Lady Worsley's Whim. And that was adapted into a miniseries starring the girl who plays Marjorie Tyrell from Game of Thrones. And it's really, really good. Natalie Dormer. Yeah, that came out last year, I think, or the year before. So it's really worth both watching that miniseries and reading the book, The Scandalous Lady W. And that's what got me into Hallie Reubenhold's work. So she's written something called The Covent Garden Ladies, Pimp General Jack and the Extraordinary Story of the Harris's List. And that's what this particular miniseries is inspired by. But her book, I mean, the book isn't sort of like a narrative with characters. I think inspired by is the writers of this have taken the milieu and all her deep historical research into what it was like to be in that era and then created a story on top of it. So if you buy the book, you're not going to get this story, but you're going to get a lot of really cool social history around it. So I would really recommend that. And I would definitely, definitely recommend Lady Worsley's Whim and the miniseries. They're exceptionally good.
And that's how the series starts out as well. So Lucy reads out the Harris's list and like comments on all of the so Fanny's traits, Kitty. Then they're all going around and they have their own titles. So what was Emily Lacey's? Hers was like Mistress of Quim, I think.
Yep.
Or the Countess of Quim.
Yes.
And that's all very true to life. And apparently the prostitutes did then sort of take great pride in their description. That became kind of like their calling card. So I think that was a really brilliant way of acknowledging the inspiration for the show and showing that these women weren't ashamed of what they did. It was a profession that they were good at and took pride in. And, you know, this was very important. This was their social media presence.
And I found it really interesting that the creators in the lead up to Harlots did not want to acknowledge Rubenthal's book at all. They're like, oh, our writers did so much research. And she actually, Rubenthal put on Twitter that she was like, the series is coming out and they've obviously used my book and I have not heard anything from the people.
Really? So I didn't know that at all.
Yeah, a couple historians retweeted and put it on there, and like, this happens all the time. You know, she took 7 years to research this and they've just taken it. So when it says inspired by, it's kind of the creators begrudgingly going, well, obviously when we pitched the idea, we might have read the book, I guess.
So have they now agreed, does she get some kind of cut from the show now? Like, if she's formally acknowledged, is she getting some financial remuneration, I would hope?
I would assume so, because on her Twitter, she's been promoting Harlots now. You have the inspired by at the beginning of the credits. It was quite interesting. It must have been when Harlots was just first greenlit or something like that. And I don't even know if she went to set or anything like that. But at least now they've acknowledged all the work that she did, because I think she did two books on Harris's list. There's like an annotated one, which is like all the social history. And then there's a more abridged version, which is a bit more digestible.
Okay. Well, that's really
I'm
fascinating.
I'm glad of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Did not know.
So who was your favorite character?
Oh, gosh. For me, it was still Mar Wells, because I just think she's very nuanced, very strong, a real battle axe in some respects. Like, even the way she sits, like, she sits with her legs, like, astride like a man. She's very much in power, but she's still vulnerable. Like, when her husband leaves her, she's really upset. And I think she genuinely is trying to do the right thing, even if it leads her to some callous decisions. So I thought that was fascinating. But I also liked, what's the name of the S&M mistress? Because she was pretty no-nonsense, too.
Nancy.
Yeah, but she has a real heart, though, doesn't she? She's like the moral centre of the piece. When Mar Wells goes too far, she stays loyal to her, but she does, like, call her out on shopping Emily Lacey and stuff like that. So I really liked her too. How about you guys?
There's so many big, confident, really fun characters. So Margaret is a big one. And I think I read a review and it said she's got the perfect whore laugh, which I laughed at. So I love the way that she sits as well. And she clicks her fingers as well when she's thinking about something. I think my favorite characters were Nancy, but I also really like Kitty as well.
Yeah, I love how, like, occasionally Kitty just steps off and gets shit done, and then it's always when Mar Wells is out of the house, like, Kitty gets it done, and then she comes back, and she's just not acknowledged at all. Or maybe that's the way it came across to be.
But yeah, well, some of the storylines, so we can talk about them. So I guess there's Harriet, who is a former slave. She effectively has a husband, Mr. Lennox, but they're not really married. They just live as husband and wife. And she has two children. Then
common law marriage.
Yes, common law marriage. So Mr. Lennox dies. He has an older son who takes over. And then Harriet effectively becomes his property, along with his half-brother and half-sister. But then, what was the name of the son again?
Can't remember. That's terrible, isn't it? He was such a dickhead. Ugh.
He's the Joffrey of the series. He's like,
he totally everyone is.
Benjamin Lennox.
Benjamin, right. So Benjamin signs the papers to give Harriet her freedom, but then says, but your children, they're still mine. So this leads Harriet to going to Margaret Wells and taking up work in her house. And then her mission is to get her children back. However, this leads to her betraying Margaret as well. So I guess we'll talk a bit more, but Lucy kills one of the, well, I guess her potential keeper, Harriet, and all the girls know about it. So Harriet threatens Margaret unless she gives her enough money. So she does. Then she takes the money, and that's to buy her children back. But the Benjamin consistently says he always wants a higher price. So he starts off with, you can buy your children back, then it's buy them for £100, then it could be more as well. So she forms a close bond with Will, and he helps her get the children back. I always thought that it was really naive for Harriet to go on her own, though, so I'm so glad that Will went with her to help, because I don't think it would have ended as well if it was Harriet on her own. Even if she gave Benjamin, like, say, £150, I still think that wouldn't have been enough.
She's very naive, because she thinks it's about a business deal where she can pay the money he wants. But for him, it's about coercive control, because he's jealous of the fact that his father loved this slave woman and had kids with her, rather than, you know, spending time and attention on him, the legitimate heir. So he's always going to ratchet up the price and move the goalposts. Like, even if she turns up with the money, he's not going to give her the kids, because he wants to make her suffer. And she doesn't get that. She just thinks, if I sleep with enough men, earn enough money, I'll get the £100, I'll get my kids. And I mean, I kind of don't respect her for that in a way, because she's had such a hard life. You'd think she would have become a bit more savvy. But it is a heart-wrenching story.
I feel like if she did just go to Benjamin, gave him whatever she had in that pouch, £100, then he would just keep the money, still keep the children, and then it's like her word against
exactly.
his.
Exactly. Yeah. I completely agree with you. I think she's utterly naive in that respect. And even the way, like, you know, Mar Wells's daughter has killed an aristocratic man and the other one's being done for it. And she's screaming, I want the money for my kids. I want the money for my kids. Like, trying to blackmail her. And I'm like, you really do overplay your hand. You don't know what you're... She just frustrated me as a character. And when Mar Wells just picked, you know, went and got whatever money she had, which wasn't much, and just dumped it on the table, almost just to get her to shut up. I just found her profoundly irritating, which is bad.
But at the time... Yeah, but at the time that was happening, Benjamin Lennox had essentially said, like, I am, you know, shipping out to Virginia tomorrow night. If you don't have the money, I'm taking your kids with me and you'll never see them again. Like, we're back off to Virginia. So I think it was, like, pressure on for Harriet as well. It was just horrible timing.
But I think there's ways and means of getting what you want. And the screaming like exactly. an angry child is not going to achieve it.
Exactly. And she was incredibly naive into, you know, all the dealings that she'd had with the Lennox kid, thinking that he would ever give her children back, especially when he told her, it was like, you know, when my mother was dying, my father was off fucking you. Like, there is no way that he's ever going to not be so overly emotional about Harriet.
Yep.
And that's one of the big storylines throughout the series. So it's all about Margaret preparing her daughter for this new line of work, that she sells her virginity to the highest bidder in the first episode, and that is to Howard, who is Charlotte's keeper. So he does that to get back at Charlotte. So Charlotte is Lucy's sister, and because Charlotte and Howard have a fight, that he first of all pays the highest price to get Lucy's virginity, then he consistently goes to her whenever Charlotte and he have a fight. Then just things go a bit too far. So first of all, he rapes Charlotte. Then the next week he tries to rape Lucy, and that leads to his death. So then Margaret has to cover everything up to save her daughter from being burned.
I loved in the scene where Mar Wells essentially tells William North that, you know, she's not going to get a surgeon, and William's response is like, you've damned your daughter to hell because now she's murdered him. Like, you know, Mar Wells is just thinking along the lines of an earthly existence, and all of a sudden you just get this dose of Georgian religion, which most people had, you know, bar Hugh. And he's like, you're not saving her, you're damning her. And when Mar Wells kills him, she's like, well, the murder's mine now, so, you know, she's fine. I really enjoyed that element of it. It was
Religion doesn't come out of this very well, does it? The only overtly religious person's deeply guilty about her own past as a prostitute.
Do either of you want to talk about, I guess, the significance of a keeper and why that was important?
So the aim of every prostitute is that rather than turning tricks with random guys for smaller amounts of money, that if you can attract the attention of a very rich man who can afford to keep you as his permanent mistress, he will then pay you an annual income, an annuity, not just for the time he keeps you as a mistress, but for life. Like you'll get a pension. And so that's ultimate financial security. But not only does it bring you financial security of an income, and he might even buy you a house, like an apartment or a house, it also gives you some social status because you won't be able to be seen in the highest, almost formal versions of society, but you can be on his arm at relatively high society events and have more informal power. So it's a way for a woman to have security and power in an age where that's very difficult. And if you ever read Michelle Phaebus' book, The Crimson Petal and the White, that's also about the importance of finding a keeper, but 100 centuries later as a prostitute.
And if you have any children with them, while they will be illegitimate, they will be very, very well looked after. You know, if you have a male child, they will
Oh,
get,
yes.
you know, a very good education. And a female child could become, you know, a governess or at least be married off to minor gentry.
Yeah, good point. And also, if you don't end up having any legitimate issue, you can get your bastard children legitimized, as we see in Song of Ice and Fire, right? So it's altogether, it's a very, in a sense, it gives you security, but it does also mean that you're not diversified. In other words, when you turn tricks, if you have a guy who's particularly violent or whatever, you just don't have to see him again. But once you're with your keeper, then you have to constantly keep him happy. And I think that's the tragedy of Charlotte Wells's existence, right? And what we see. Like, there's a very poignant bit in with Charlotte Wells where she's making love to her Irish partner. She says, "I don't know how to do this without acting. I've never had non-commercial sex effectively." And that was absolutely heartbreaking for me, because she's just had her whole life basically just trying to keep a keeper happy, and it's just constant play acting.
And what would it have meant for Charlotte? So she shames Howard in public. So then he says, "Right, I'm done with you, cutting all ties. I'm no longer your keeper." But I guess would she have been able to get another one?
Yeah, potentially, but I'm sure rumors spread, right? So you've lost your income and your pension and your flat and your clothes and your jewels. And then why would another aristocratic man take you? Because he knows that you've been bothersome to your previous master. I mean, you've really got to back your looks and your reputation, don't you? Because there's also now going to be a reputation for being difficult. So if you think of yourself an aristocratic man, he's getting a mistress because he just doesn't want to be harassed or hassled, like by his wife at home. He just wants a yes woman. And maybe they don't look for feistiness and opinionatedness and the ability to walk out. So I think it does compromise you. Charlotte Wells is different though, because she is so reputed. That's what we're made to believe, aren't we? That she's in Harris's list as the most beautiful whore in London. So maybe she'll bounce back.
Yeah, I found her relationship with George Howard really interesting, especially the conversation that they have about his wife, and he's like, "Oh, she's barren," when it's been well established that he has at least mild erectile dysfunction. And he
Exactly.
obviously doesn't sleep with his wife often
Yeah,
enough to get her
there's
pregnant.
nothing wrong with the
And
wife.
he, yeah, and he's talking about, like, "We can have a child and we'll raise it as, you know, my legitimate heir. We'll pretend that it's Caroline's." And he's just like, no, actually go home and sleep with your wife, you know, give
Yeah.
that a try.
But that's just him being self-serving and wanting an excuse to have Charlotte. I mean, the guy's just so delusional. It's just a disgusting excuse for a man, really. But you know, she has her delusions as well. I mean, she does fritter away. She gets to this amazing position, and she's almost like self-damaging or self-undermining. The way she gambles, the way she's rude to him in public, she literally throws it away. It's a deeply tragic story, I feel.
One of my favorite parts is I think it's very quotable. There's a lot of great quotes. Do you have any favorites?
I think it's less quotes for me than the put downs and the swearing. I love vintage swearing. So that just makes me happy. But have
Laudanum, gin, £5, and a roast chicken.
Bring me my chicken. How about you, Glenn?
my two well I think my two favorites are when the top so Will and Margaret are in a sit down meeting with Benjamin, and Margaret says, "You're not fit to be the wart on your father's arse." Then another one is when Bobby and Betsy are together, and what was one of the other girls says, "Oh, Betsy, you must be good. He convulses every time you touch him."
Very good.
There are others, but I can't think of them just now.
Yeah, I just do feel it's well written, not just in the big sweeps of the narrative arcs, which I do think are really compelling and interesting, but just in the micro scenes that are set up. I mean, some of the interactions between little boy Quigley and Emily Lacey and then his mum are just absolutely, I mean, he's pretty revolting, but some of them are really funny. I love a lot of them. I really do. Or for instance, the micro scene where Ma Quigley realises that the law officer who she procures these virgins for actually doesn't know who he's working for either. When she suddenly realises that the power is with her and not with him, both the writing of that scene and her acting of it was just brilliant, the way she just turns on him. So I was just laughing at him for being so sort of powerless. It's brilliant. I think it's just...
I like when you see actors who enjoy what they're given, because I feel like the women that played Margaret Wells and Lydia Quigley really just went all out with some of the stuff that they got. Like, you could just tell they're like, yes, let's do this. It's just, they must have had fun with it, just the way that it came
across. It's delicious.
Was so brilliant. One of the micro scenes that I really liked was Fanny and her copper, and when she tells him that she's pregnant and he admits that he comes to see her because his home life is so sad because him and his wife have lost so many children.
Oh, yeah, that was horrible. That was horrible. Just so brilliant, so touching. Because he's warning her in a sense that this sadness is going to come to her because she won't be able to keep her child. It was tender, but it was kind of like harsh to be kind. Oh, so moving. I agree.
And when he sees her for the first time in, I think, episode 3, when she's in, like, the new house and all dressed up, and he, you know, it's obvious that why there's a friendship there that wouldn't exist outside of their working relationship.
Completely agree. I'll tell you how good Ma Quigley is. The last costume drama I watched her in was North and South, which is a little bit old now, but it's a Victorian era social history miniseries.
Still on Netflix, still worth the watch.
Still worth watch. And in that, Ma Quigley's actress just plays this very meek, very mild renegade parson's wife who never really says anything, then just gets sort of ill and withers, and is so meek and so mild and respectable. And here she's just so vicious and strong, and it's just brilliant. It's a brilliant range of acting. She's equally compelling in both.
I think I probably found Lucy Wells the least compelling character. I really hope, like, season 2, now that Nance has kind of looked after her a bit, that we'll see her a bit more. But I found most of the time just being really frustrated with her. But one of my favourite scenes is when she finds out her virginity's been sold again. She kind of goes to the stables and finds a guy, and she's like, you've got a couple of pee, why not? Just to, you know, feel like she has some control over what's happening and it's not just her mother deciding who she's sleeping with.
She's I don't know. I mean, they've obviously cast the actress because she's quite young and pretty, but I mean, it's tough, isn't it? Because she's holding her own against Samantha Morton. For the life of me, I can't remember the name of the actress who plays Ma Quigley, but she's a very famous character actress.
Leslie Manville.
She's actually done lots of social realist film cinema in the UK as well. And then you've got, you know, younger actresses who've been in things like Downton, hugely impressive CVs. And I just felt she was a bit overshadowed in this, actually. That was kind of my point about who's the heroine. I think for viewers, she was meant to be the heroine or the protagonist that we care about, this Anjanie's journey through this world, but I don't know.
I am so glad that Margaret had a conscience, you know, she had a change of heart at the end, and she didn't go through with that with Amelia. So she...
Oh my goodness, yes. That would have been awful. That would have just been very dark and horrible.
But she was...
It wouldn't have surprised me if that happened, because normally, like, I don't feel like Lydia Quigley has any redeeming characteristics besides the love for her son, but even that is not a healthy love. She babies him and completely blankets him from life where he's not a functional adult. So there's almost like no redeeming qualities to Lydia Quigley. And I would have liked a bit more of that. You know, she only starts to feel guilt when she sees, you know, blood on the doorframe. But, you know, why shouldn't she have felt guilt before then?
Because I think you can compartmentalize. And I think what you don't know, what you pretend you don't know, what you don't physically see, you can kind of mentally block out, I think. And I think Samantha Morton's character, again, having made a mistake of giving up a girl, i.e. Emily Lacey, when she's put under pressure, she's not... I'd like to think that that is her character development, is that she won't do that again. You know, Fanny does keep the baby. you know, there has to be some development. And so that's going to be quite interesting. Can you imagine these two women joining forces against that evil den of virgin sacrifices? That would be quite something in season two. I've got no idea what's going to happen.
I hope that happens. I would love them on the same side.
Yeah,
it'd be quite... Nance is an enforcer.
I mean, maybe that's too soon to happen
Nance
in season
Birch,
two.
That's her last name, because yeah. she always has the
Birch.
Whip.
Yeah, exactly.
Birch, yeah.
But anyway, I think there's lots of good stuff in there, because as much as these two characters do quite extreme stuff, they have movement of character, which I think is really nice in the writing.
I was a bit surprised when, so one of the backstories is that Margaret was sold by her mother when she was 10 years old and for a pair of shoes. And that's another great line, because Charlotte says, "Oh, I've heard so much about those shoes, I could start a cobbler." So
that's a great line. That's a really good line.
The brothel that she grew up within was Lydia Quigley's. But then in the final episode, Lydia says to Charlotte, you were born in my house, which surprised me, because I would think as soon as a girl was pregnant, she would be gone anyway.
Which hints at the fact that there must have been some kind of closer friendship between the two women at some point. They must have been closer than just brothel keeper and one of her girls. Because otherwise she wouldn't have kicked her out. In other words, there's a really fascinating backstory that I hope we get more of.
Yeah, because in one of the times that Mark Quigley is talking to her son, she says, "I can't believe you were the child that I kept." So it would be interesting
but
to see.
But because he's a son, you know, I guess.
Yeah, but I don't know. Not that I like flashbacks, but I would like a flashback there. Especially like
not necessarily a flashback, but just an explanation. Yeah, I think that this is our summer haul, isn't it? Yeah.
Oh, and the French whore. I love the French whore. Every time there's subtitles on, she's fantastic.
Yeah, what she says to her tricks when they're
the
in bed.
She's like,
yeah.
like, money, 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 money.
Your dick is small. This is boring. And... you smell like a sort of cesspit. Yeah, brilliant.
Oh, I love when Emily Lacey has all these scars and bruises, and she's really... She like has an outburst with all the other girls in the room. Then they all leave except for the French girl, and she says, "Don't be nice to me." And then she says, "Don't worry, I'm a bitch."
Another totally great line.
One thing that I would have liked to have seen was like delving into male prostitution. I think that would have been like so fascinating if they had
you get
like
a little bit with Pip.
Oh yeah,
mm-hmm. But not much at all. There's. You know, the male gigolo, and then there's Pippin, the way that the other prostitutes treat him. I'm not too sure it's because he is a gay man selling himself or because he's in Lydia Quigley's pay. It doesn't really go into why they treat him so badly, but there's so many times that he turns up and either helps them or when his partner's dying and he can't afford a doctor, and if he could afford a doctor, which doctor would come to the slums to help him?
I feel like there might have been a man, but I'm not sure if it was a woman or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe that's something to investigate in further series. And I wonder if it's just because having written this, admittedly or not, based on Hallie Reubenhold's work, and her work is about the female experience of prostitution. So maybe they will. I mean, I like the fact that they gave Charlotte Wells a love interest who was also sexually exploited to show that a little bit. And I really love the character, the gay guy who's trying to save his lover and can't because he can't afford the medicine and no one will come. So I think it's a bit like slavery. It wasn't the central concern, but this kind of series is socially aware. So it does weave in other stories that are quite interesting. Even having a very sympathetic lesbian character, I thought, and one who's more closeted, I thought was really nice. So I'm hoping, you know, that you can't do everything in an 8-episode first series.
Oh, true.
but they have laid some very nice seeds of stories to explore, looking at other types of oppression and exploitation, which I think will be very interesting. It's a very humane series, you know?
Yeah, because of that character, I've spent way too much time reading essays by Richter Norton, and he... is a historian who's done quite a lot of work on gay subculture, but he's got quite a few very, very good essays about homosexuality within the Georgian period. That's fascinating, like Molly Houses and Cruising Grounds back then and all that kind of, you know, the primary source evidence. And he goes into it all and it's quite fascinating and how it is very, very separate from female prostitution.
Oh, please forward the links to those articles so we can put them in the podcast notes on
Oh, yes.
WordPress. Because I'd love to read them. I'm sure lots anyone else listening who's really into harlots might like to read them too. That'd be really cool.
So to sum up, what would you rate the series out of 5 lemon cakes?
Oh, I mean, assuming a five can only truly go to like a The Wire or Sopranos or Fargo, then I would give this a 4.5. I would give it whatever is the highest rating without it being like iconic. And maybe it will get there as it progresses. But I think it's really solid. I really enjoyed it. And I can't wait for season two. How about you guys?
I would rate it as a 4, just a solid work, really exciting stories, really gripping as well, and a lot of attention to detail on the costumes, some really recognizable faces in the story as well. Great acting. So yep, I would rate it as a 4 out of 5.
Solid. How about you?
I'm a bit more negative, but it would be a four for me, but the music choices in it puts it at like a 3.5 for me because there's just some obnoxious
Oh,
amounts of
really?
dubstep.
I
I love
loved
the
all
music.
that. I thought that was so cool.
It works
That
in
theme
Peaky
tune is
Blinders,
so
but it just,
catchy.
the theme tune's not bad. I just found at times it took me really out of it. Like 3.5, 3.75, like not quite four. Like I'd take a bite out of like the fourth lemon cake because I didn't get it all.
Oh, I loved it. I loved it in the
That's.
way that I love Marie Antoinette, the Sofia Coppola that then has like punk in it. Because I think it just shows a bit of an irreverence and it just it acknowledges the fact that we're modern viewers and we're recreating something that isn't going to be factually correct about the past. I like the fact that it has that bit of artificiality to it. So yeah. Oh my goodness, I can't believe that's what you didn't
And the
like.
costuming was great because I rewatched Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette, and just it is set slightly later time period, but not by much. But the extravagance, and you see it in like Lydia Quigley as well. Like there's lots of pale blues and pale pinks where that fabric is quite obviously a lot more expensive. And then you look at the costumes of the lower class people, and it's a lot more homespun. And Lydia Quigley dyeing her eyebrows pink. Like I love it. I love it. I just thought it was fantastic at times.
And you can even draw an analogy with the fact that if you compare the whores that work for Lydia Quigley, again, are all in those pastel colours. So it's very much like Marie Antoinette at the Royal Court. But the people who work for Ma Wells, and Charlotte Wells, when she's seen drunkenly straggling through the park, and again, quite expensive clothes, but they're always quite garish colours, like mustard yellows and bright reds. And that is analogous to Asia Argento in Marie Antoinette when she plays the mistress of the king, who is seen as common and coarse, and this Italian whore at
Madame du
court,
Barry.
Madame du Barry.
Madame du
Yeah,
Barry.
so I
Gosh,
love the
she's one of my
way,
favorite people.
so I love the way that the clothing signals, even when it's actually quite expensive, it signals the attempt to be classy but the failure to achieve it, versus Quigley, who really has. Her whores do look like upper class women, except for the fact that they're whores, whereas no one's going to mistake Ma Wells's girls for gentle women, put it that way. Maybe the younger one. I mean, it's interesting the way that, the elder and younger sisters do dress quite differently. So yeah, I like that.
And the medical stuff in there is really good because this is one of my weird things is, and they're not ever going to do it in enough historical dramas, is that people back then were a lot uglier than us now because things didn't heal well ever. There was no soap, so even a small scratch or cut wouldn't heal. Like you'd have keloid scars and that kind of thing. And when you see the woman with tertiary syphilis and the gummos, and when Charles Quigley is coming, when they bring him out of the laudanum stupor and they give him a mustard poultice and it actually burns his forehead, like that's what happened. And I love those little details. It's not nice back then. And good old facial syphilis sores. I'm glad they did that, which is a weird thing to like and a bit gross, but yeah.
Not at all. I mean, one of the things I enjoyed most about reading Michelle Faber's The Crimson Petal and the White was that in his description of the brothel houses of Soho, he would talk about, it's just the little factual details that I think enrich it. Like how the prostitutes, because they didn't really
For the
have.
longest time, I thought, oh.
The prostitutes didn't have time to remake their beds between tricks. So what they would do is make one bed and basically have these very thin, cheap sheets and layer them with waxed paper so that whatever bodily fluids would go through that one sheet onto the wax paper wouldn't go to the ones after, then they'd just rip off that sheet and that bit of wax paper. and send it out to be laundered. And then, so that was like a money saving, time saving device, because you need to just get back on the saddle with the next guy. And then you'd always employ or have these little kids in the brothel houses, and they weren't all kicked out, these babies, because you needed 5, 6, 7 year old boys to take, just keep taking these sheets to be laundered. Stuff like that fascinates me, just the mechanics of how you operated the seamy world. Sorry, Tanya.
And in the harlots, they show the girls like washing themselves between johns. Like, it's not nice. It's, yeah, you know, leg on a chair, wash that out, next guy.
Absolutely. It's a production line. And therefore, the idea of being a kept woman like Charlotte, where you maybe only have to fuck him once a night and it's one guy, and the rest of the day you can eat nice food and you can just sleep in bed all day. You can have a nice hot bath in a proper bathtub and be clean and be relatively disease-free. I mean, those are huge, huge advantages aside from the money, and shows you, in a way, what she throws away. Like, was it really that bad being with him? He was simple-minded and egotistical. All you had to do was flatter him and you could have had a relatively easy life. I don't know.
And I like that she's bad at money, because some sociological studies now show that people from a lower SES, when they are given large amounts of money, especially lottery wins and that kind of thing, they spend their money so much quicker than more middle class or upper middle class people who are given either large inheritances or lottery wins. They're able to kind of budget and think of money as an investment, where someone like Charlotte Wells, who has come from that lower end of the spectrum, wouldn't have any concept of that kind of money at all. But neither does, you know, George Howard, and he was born into it and he's just using his wife's money. Oh, I love the conversation between Charlotte and Caroline, and she's like, well, this is all yours, I guess. And she's like, yeah, it is. It's my inheritance. It's my money, but the Lord doesn't recognize that.
Yeah, it's quite literally it isn't, because once you marry, it's not anymore. I mean, I think with Charlotte Wells, her money, she's bad with money as far as she gambles, but maybe the gambling is her way of self-medicating, like distracting herself from the fact that she's a prisoner effectively in this relationship. But you're right. I mean, it does show her whole nature in season one is effectively grand gestures, over emotional, not rational, whereas her mum is depicted as being, you know, ultra cool and ultra rational. I like the idea in season two of them potentially working to the same end, or her taking on some of that conspiratorial ruthlessness of her mum, and the mum softening a little bit, learning the lesson of sacrificing Emily Lacey. So it's going to be interesting to see where these characters go. I'm really fascinated.
Please let there be a series two.
Do we not know that there's definitely going to be one? Has it not been renewed?
I don't think so.
Not yet, but I think because Hulu and ITV Encore, because it's like both of them, it might just come out a bit later, because I think Hulu are very distracted by A Handmaiden's Tale right now.
Well, that's annoying. But do you know what the viewing figures were like in the UK, Glenn? Have you seen any numbers?
300,000.
Is that good or bad these days? I don't even know.
I don't think it's that good. I think it was like live, people that actually watched it when it was on, it was 200,000. But then once you add on demand, it's like 300,000. And that was for the first episode. But I don't know if that's good or not. I mean, it's good for the channel. I think it's probably the most popular show that's on that channel. But
it's a weird channel for ITV, for Hulu to have partnered with. I sort of feel if that had been on Sky Atlantic or, I don't know, BBC Two or something, it would have got much higher figures.
When I first seen it, I could tell it was an ITV Encore show. I don't think it would fit with Sky Atlantic.
Why not?
In terms of just the types of shows that Sky Atlantic show, I don't think it would fit with it. Fit with their, you know, schedule.
Fair enough. Oh, that's going to be tragic, because I really want to... And that's a sign of a good show. I really want to see what happens to these characters next. I'd be quite heartbroken if it wasn't another series.
But just, I guess, any podcasts coming up, Bina?
So I'm hosting Reread 40, which is going to be Cat 3, Sansa 3 and Davos 4. Excited to do that. We've got a couple of OG vassals. We've got a brand new podcaster who also has come from the YouTubes. So that'll be a nice mix of people, I think. And then I've just read a really fascinating book about, actually not technically a serial killer, but a British post-war seducer of women and brutaliser of them. So hoping to get together another psycho-sicko serial killer roundtable with Matt Varley. Sorry, cut that out because he doesn't like the name in full. With Varley on the forums, FT Ward, maybe Notary Lady, hopefully. And that's about it, I think, for the moment. Always up for any British TV ones, Glenn, though, as you know.
I had recorded one for Big Little Lies, but as you know, that failed, or for those that don't know that.
I love that show. Failed. I'd happily do another one of those.
I'm hoping to do another one. This time, have more people on it as well.
Oh, man. I was meant to make it, then I didn't because of travel, but I love that show so much. Oh, I forgot to mention, I also went for 4 days to Dubrovnik, which is where King's Landing was shot, seasons 2 onwards. So I'm hoping to put out a short podcast I did with Adam Groundsnow, just describing what it was like to do the Game of Thrones tour, if anyone's interested in that. So that'll come out soon too.
Oh, fantastic. And Katie, anything you've seen the look of on the forums?
Hopefully we've not put you off and you'll sign up for more.
We need a pressure Claudius the Fool into doing the American Gods book podcast.
I can. I'll pass on that message.
But he's so busy. Just pressure him. Just daily text messages.
I think it is hard. Like, he owns a bit. I think when you're a small business owner, it's pretty crazy. And it also means he can't really do weekends. But I will put pressure on him. See if we can make that happen. Anyway, this has been amazingly cool. Actually, I've probably got to bug out. Sorry, Glenn, for derailing with lots of random chat.
I get distracted easy. I'm sorry. It's almost 4 a.m. I've had a coffee. Bouncing off the walls.
That's okay. Well, thank you once again for joining the podcast, and thanks everyone for listening.
Thank you very much for hosting. This has been really fun.
Yes, thank you for,
You're welcome. Thanks, everyone.
I don't want to make popping my cherry joke because it's not really funny after talking about harlots.
Anyway, it's been a pleasure.
Cut that out.
It'd be appropriate,
it
probably.
Is, yeah.
Yes.
I couldn't end up getting a copy of the last episode of Harlots, so just catch me up on what happened, because I don't think the last episode will change my views on, like, the series or characters or anything.
What happened in the last episode? So Charlotte basically decides to stupidly trust Ma Quigley because she thinks her mum's just abandoned her to favour the younger daughter. So she basically says...
Oh, I can see why she would do that.
Yeah, so she says she'll work for her. So the mother's basically left with nothing because her black lover basically has seen another side to her after the murder and decides that he doesn't really want much to do with her.
So it's all... a ruse. So she goes to Lydia quickly, but her mission is to actually bring her down because she thinks that because Margaret started out at her brothel, that's why that led her to this life.
She's
actually working undercover to bring down Lydia quickly, and that'll be like a storyline for series 2, hopefully, if we get one.
So did I miss something horrible? I must have missed something very big. This is what happens when you watch TV late at night and you're falling asleep in bed.
So Fanny has the baby,
yep.
And at the start, Margaret is like, you know, you can't keep it. But then at the end, she's won over and it looks like she does get to keep it. Harriet goes to get her children back from Mr. Lennox and Will helps her.
Yep.
And they basically kidnap the kids back.
Wait, does she keep all of Margaret Wells' money that, like, she handed her
she
at the end of
back
episode
Margaret.
7?
Charlotte is rescued by Lydia quickly. No one discovers Lucy committed murder, and then she has, like, some training from Nancy as well on how to be sadistic, I guess. This is off topic before we start talking about harlots, but did anyone watch Eurovision?
I didn't, because my boyfriend really hates the concept of Eurovision and I feel kind of sad because I love its cheesy goodness. But I was excited that Portugal won and it's actually like a decent song.
Oh, I didn't think so. I thought that it was so bland compared to...
Oh, really?
Like, my favourite was Germany. No, my favourite was Norway. Then it was Germany, but they didn't actually do that well. And Germany was like bottom of the list as well.
I was actually amazed Britain got any votes after Brexit, I have to say. The problem is, Glenn, I've only had the winner, so I haven't, because I didn't watch it, I don't know what all the other songs were like. But I'm always amazed that Australia is somehow in Eurovision. That's legend.
Australia gave UK 12 points, you know.
Oh, thank you, Australia. We love you too.
Yeah, that's Miff Warhurst. She was on the voting panel for Australia, and she's a fantastic radio personality / TV personality. Online, if you look at Spicks and Specs, it's not running anymore, but it's an Australian panel show about music, and it's so funny. It's, yeah, it's very, very good. It's like QI, but no one has done classics.
So is Eurovision a big thing? Like, do people watch it in Australia?
Yeah, it's like there's, I don't, because I don't really get it. I get the glitz and glamour, but I've just never sat down and actually watched the entire thing. But a lot of people do. Like, it's hard to explain with our TV channels, but it's on like SBS, which is kind of like our secondary BBC. Like, it's all the weird shit. Actually, it's not weird shit, but it's all the stuff that normally doesn't get put on TV. So when I was growing up, like Saturday night used to be like anime night on SBS, and it would be like not the dubs version, so only subtitles, and they would play like Cowboy Bebop and, you know, Neon Genesis and all these amazing things. So at the moment, they're having like the past like year or so, they've had this massive like Nordic noir push, like all these amazing Scandinavian shows on that you normally wouldn't get anywhere else. Like you wouldn't even get them on Netflix over here, because our Netflix has like 30% of what Netflix actually offers. So, yeah, Eurovision used to be one of those things that people would watch and drink to.
I think Australia,
which I think everyone does,
are
to
new.
Yeah, it's our second
I think
year.
That's what I was going to say, yeah. But Australia did, I think Australia was like leading the list, but then the public votes came in and then they got punted back down to third place last year.
Yeah, but that's Guy Sebastian. Fuck him. Sorry. He won like the first version of Australian Idol, and he's involved in like Hillsong and just some really disagreeable church bullshit that he just like keeps covered up. Just like, no, I didn't get like all the weird Christian teenagers to vote for me in like 2004. No, that's not how I won. Ugh. Sorry. I just don't like Guy Sebastian.
Don't worry. You're fitting right into the Vok life, because you've got sort of vengeful grudge rants. That's how we do.